Welcome to the Education Investment Podcast. In a world where investors are looking for stable and growing long-term returns with social impact, the education sector is becoming increasingly attractive. We speak to leading educators, operators, and investors in the education sector around the world to explore this growing investment theme alongside our listeners. From preschools to K-12 schools to higher education and vocational education, from edtech to education infrastructure, from VC investors to private equity and family offices, we explore it all. I'm your host, Monde Ngosi. Education has always been a big part of my life because my mother founded a school which was across the road from our home. I have benefited from excellent schools and teachers in South Africa and the US. I went on to study education and I'm now very grateful to be an investor in the sector that I love.
All opinions expressed by podcast guests are solely their own opinions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Today, I'm privileged to host Malvin Lubega for a conversation on edtech and corporate learning. We'll discuss edtech and corporate learning from Malvin's unique vantage point as both an operator and investor in these sectors. Malvin was a founding executive of GoOne, which is an edtech unicorn that is one of the market leaders in online corporate learning globally. GoOne's investor base includes the likes of SoftBank, Microsoft, Salesforce, and Y Combinator. After his executive role at GoOne, Malvin transitioned from operating to investing. He's now a partner at Briga, a venture capital firm headquartered in Paris, with assets under management exceeding 700 million euros. Among others, Malvin is a Rhodes Scholar, a World Economic Forum Young Global Leader, and an Archbishop Tutu Fellow. He holds degrees in actuarial science from the University of Cape Town and in education and public policy from Oxford. I've known Malvin for almost two decades. We went to undergrad together and we also served together on a corporate board. And since we met as teenagers, I've always felt that Malvin was going to have a large impact on the world. And it's been an absolute joy for me to watch him go out and make that happen. Malv, it's wonderful to have you here today. Yeah, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much.
All right. Let's, before getting into corporate learning and edtech, I first want to learn a bit more about you. So tell us a bit about your journey, a bit about your family and where you grew up.
Yeah. So for myself, born and raised in South Africa, parents of Ugandan origin. But ultimately, education's always been a big part of, I think, the narrative of my family and my own journey. My mother says I'm the last born so far, so I don't know what that means for my siblings and myself, but always ready to be usurped. But I think definitely growing up in Johannesburg, you know, going to my local government school and then having the benefit of education at, you know, one of the top private schools in the country, then doing my undergrad, as you mentioned, here in South Africa, and then studying abroad. I think it's been an interesting journey, but what I've realized is the role of technology in just how one thinks about education. And that's really been a big underpin on my journey, but ultimately really passionate about solving problems using technology.
Okay. I'd love to double click a bit more on the family side first. Yeah. So you mentioned that your parents are of Ugandan origin and yeah. You've got siblings as well. So just tell me a bit more what brought them to South Africa and bit about your siblings as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. So my parents, I grew up in Uganda. And so my parents actually came from fairly large families, and I think many of the family members are still in the rural areas, but my mother was one of over 30 siblings on her side alone. And so
30 siblings.
My grandfather was an amorous man. but I think, you know, one thing he believed in was education and the importance of education, always making sure that he provided those opportunities, for his children. And so my parents grew up with this mutual passion for education and the power of what it can mean for them. And so they were very fortunate to receive scholarships, both for their undergraduate and postgraduate studies, which took them overseas to the UK under the Commonwealth scholarships at the time. And so that's where they really deeply connected. And so it was actually through that that they found their way, I guess, back into the Commonwealth. You know, sister was born in Uganda, brother Botswana, and me here, in terms of, you know, doing the time within the Commonwealth. And so father was a medical doctor. My mother was a vet. And so my brother's also a medical doctor. So I'm the black sheep now in the household. But definitely it's been a big part of that journey. And my sister and I was close with my brother on the medical side as well. And so ultimately, if I think about education, as a coming from a family of professionals, it's been a big part of what has enabled us to get to where we are as a family.
I identify with that so much, Malf. It's education has been such an integral part of the development of my family as well, both on my mom's side and on my father's side. And it is, it's very cheesy to say, but it really can change the trajectory of an entire family and over multiple generations. So that's really wonderful to hear, Malf. And you've got an entire family also in the medical profession. So I hear your point there on being the black sheep of the family. Two professions. It's either you're a doctor or a failure. So now that's lovely. And just staying there in childhood, what would you consider some of the formative experiences of your upbringing?
Yeah, I think, you know, so unfortunately my father passed away when I was fairly young, eight years old through a car accident. And I think it's interesting to also reflect on, you know, my mother, I guess, being my first teacher, in terms of how she taught me not only, you know, the value of people, but also purpose as a community. So my mother is the eldest of those, of the kids that were, of my aunts and uncles. And so she always felt a need to like almost be that older, bigger sister. And I think we've always had a strong sense of community, in our homes and what we did. And so my fondest memories growing up is, you know, my family celebrates everything from a marriage to a this to a that. And so just having get togethers with family members growing up and just coming together to celebrate each other and using that sense of community. And so that's been very, a key thing for me when I think about the impact I want to have in my life. When I think through just, it was really a community that came together for me as I was growing up and thinking through how do I then have a bigger impact in my life beyond just my immediate nuclear family, as it were. And so definitely have fond formative memories of that with my siblings.
She must be an extraordinary lady, to raise three children. You know, you were only 8 years old when your dad passed away. So, you know, from a very, very young age. So thank you very much for sharing that. And, just so much respect for your mother and what she's achieved.
The legend.
and maybe a little bit more then on your own educational journey. So when we met for the first time, you were at St. John's at the time, you were head boy of St. John's. So tell me a bit about your journey at St. John's and how that experience was for you.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, so I'm very fortunate to, one, I think I've attended a school like St. John's, definitely both from an academic and even non-academic perspective, just holistically developing as a young man, I think was incredible. But I remember some mother used to work for the Department of Agriculture for a number of years. And so she would drive past St. John's, on her way to work in City Deep, going to the abattoir. She said, like, you know, maybe one day one of my kids could go there. But the reality is we had no means to afford going to any to that school. And so it was one day we had like a career fair in the local mall and we saw that they had all the schools up and said, look, St. John's is there. Let's put application in. I put application in, but actually I was actually just almost missed the scholarship examinations. And so I wrote the exam for the entrance exam on the then receptionist's desk. And then the next week was the scholarship exam, which I was fortunate to get an offer to come write. And I think it was through that journey, I think it's very easy to be like, okay, I didn't go to a, you know, tier one private school. And you go to some of these examinations, everyone has like scrolls and their sentences on their badges. And you're just there with like my brother's old green faded blazer that's torn and cut up from the soccer match that we played at. So it was a different experience. But I think what I really valued and very fortunate to have won a scholarship to St. John's during my time there. And so still today serve the school and serve on the council from that perspective. But I think I really valued the experience in St. John's because it's grounded in, you know, Christian faith and tradition, the Anglican tradition, but definitely made some really deep friends. And I think that boarding experience was incredible to enable me to ground myself and grow as a young man. I'm even not necessarily growing up with my father being there, my brother also being that particular father figure. And so definitely a crucible of fire, as it were, but definitely I'm very proud of, one, the ability to go to the school, but also two, I think how it framed who I am today.
That's a wonderful advert for the school. And if we move further on in your academic journey, so University of Cape Town, and then particularly interested at Oxford.
Yeah.
While you were at Oxford, you had a range of things you could have studied, and one of those you chose to study was education.
Yeah.
So what drew you to that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, so beyond the link to education thing, it's a fascinating one where, so at Oxford, I studied education technology. But ultimately, as I mentioned, I always had a key thinking on education. So when I studied actual science, at UCT, it was more, I really liked the quantitative side of things and thinking through how does data influence decision making. At that point in time, there was no AI. So I measured statistics. I mean, it was all good. And so I was fascinated by numbers and how they can be used in different contexts. So that's been front of mind for me. And so that really thought like, look, so it was like almost the deepest applied, I guess, statistics and numbers and data I could find myself in at that particular point in time. I did consider medicine, but then I thought it would be the black sheep, and take the turn. And I think definitely a great experience there, just thinking through, one, you know, not only thinking about numbers and data, but also about, you know, finance and investing and so forth. And so, you know, beginning like an investment club. And I know you were heavily involved, I think, in InvestSoc back in the day and, you know, starting to invest, even in the undergraduate realm. And so, you know, you're inspired by Warren Buffett, Phil Fisher, Benjamin Graham, all these like deep value investing, greats. Cause at the time I was an Alan Gray fellow. Yes. And Alan Gray, I was like, I don't know how you go from doing finance one to actually managing like a multi-billion-dollar manager. And I was like, I thought there was a jumper missing there. And so we took matters into our own hands and began to invest some of our friends' money that had won scholarships, whatever spare money we had at the time. Obviously, it was our life savings, but it wasn't much at the time. But we took ourselves very seriously. I mean, in doing that, but I think it was through that again where so the education opportunities that we had that we were able to come together. I mean, we have some scholarships as well at the time and to be able to apply ourselves in that particular way. And so did that and did fairly well. But was fairly interesting was when some of the team members we brought onto the investment team began working, they couldn't trade stocks anymore because of compliance and began to look at more, let's call it micro P and venture capital. So this is probably now, over 13 years ago. And the reality is that many of the companies we're investing in, when you ask them like, look, what are your biggest pain points, especially the smaller companies, they said they couldn't find people the right kind of skills they needed for their jobs. And we're like, yes, but why don't you train them? And they're like, no, it's too expensive. They don't own the job. These are often like startups and early stage companies. Mm-hmm. And then when I reflect on my experience, you know, having worked in management consulting, where we're working very large organizations, very well resourced companies, but often many of the problems that we were solving as consultants were often a result of them not investing in their staff's capabilities. And when you look at the tools that they were using to invest in their staff, like being onboarded through like the secondment process, is left much to be desired. And so you realize that the big guys with the money arguably weren't getting it right in terms of upskilling their staff, but the smaller businesses thought they couldn't afford to do so. And so there was definitely something missing in terms of how people were learning within a professional setting. Especially when you look at the tools that were there at the time, they left much to be desired, almost similar to they were linked, I think, more to the administration and tracking of training than actually delivery. And I think that's where there was a disjuncture on how do you make, you know, learning brighter and more active. And so it was at that point in time when I was fortunate to get the scholarship to the UK, where I then decided to focus on education, learning and technology, because I felt that there was something broken in how technology was being delivered in the professional learning setting.
For our listeners, I didn't mention your CV so long that I didn't mention that you worked at Boston Consulting Group. So the management consulting you're referring to is before becoming an entrepreneur, immediately after university, started his career at the Boston Consulting Group.
Yes.
And that's what he's referring to there. Yeah. Okay. Maybe then just the final question before we get over to some of the other topics, is if people look from the outside, often a successful career looks like a straight line when looked at from afar. Whereas we all know in reality, it's never like that. There's ups and downs. So maybe if you could just share one anecdote, what have you done where prior to doing it, you felt a real fear of failure or worried, you know, deep in your gut before you did it? And how did you overcome that?
I could think about this podcast coming in here, you know, Monday being a bigger person than me. But, I think, you know, it's interesting, you know, and to your point around taking a step back and looking at that, you know, that arc, whether it's an exponential curve, straight line, whatever it may be, of one's journey, the further back you go, the smoother it looks. And I think definitely reflecting on my journey to date, because we're all still building and still trying to add value in our ecosystems, was probably the time when deciding whether to go back into a, call it corporate role versus actually start Go One. Because at that point in time, you know, I'd saved out some money during my working time, but I'd been a student for 2 years and studying in the UK was not cheap, even on scholarship. And so it's all doing like, you know, your bank balance says you probably go back to corporate, but you're like, actually, I've got a unique opportunity to actually do something that I'm uniquely placed to do.
And you were young, how old?
I was young. I must have been then 23. And so like, it's a bit tricky because also at that point in time, you think to yourself, what am I uniquely placed to do? And so that's what I try to almost, I always say, like, look, if I'm doing something that somebody else should be doing, I probably shouldn't be doing it. Because ultimately my career goal is to create 100,000 jobs and sustainable jobs, that is. And the biggest challenge there is you probably have the best chance of doing so as an entrepreneur. And so in thinking through that, it was very difficult because on one hand, you're like, look, you know, you come from an African family where, you know, there are many people you are supporting for education and so forth. And so it's hard to think, like, I remember back then when we started out, after our first year, I think my annual salary offer I had for a job was 3 times the annual revenue I had as a business. And you're in the back of your mind, you think to yourself, you're like, so if I took this job and gave a third of my salary to the business, technically we're net better off. And so those kind of things I think are difficult. And also because I think to your point around a successful career, it's a line. And so the issue is, do you let your ego get ahead of you of actually grinding? Because look, when you're building Go1, I mean, to be fair, most of our presence was outside of South Africa. Initially, our clients were global and so forth. And so the reality is that people, it wasn't like a B2C product where guys could be like, oh no, it's Coca-Cola, this is that. And so you're there in the grind building a B2B platform, working from home and coffee shops. It's not necessarily glorious, like, you know, management consulting, you're flying first class, you're there like taking photos of new countries each time. And so I found that it was one, not only overcoming the ego and that risk of failure, but also more importantly, asking yourself the question, like, if I look back, you know, in 50 years time, will I regret this particular decision? And also, what's the relative downside? Because the idea is, worst case scenario, I could go to my mother's house and be like, mom, I tried the startup, I bombed out, can I take my bunk bed again? And you start building again. And so I think I was
fortunate.
So I think for me, it was definitely a fear of failure, but also realizing that there's so much potential and upside if you do get it right, and something which I felt uniquely placed to do with my co-founders.
That's wonderful. That's really powerful, Bob. And I particularly identified with the point on it's not about looking great on LinkedIn or Instagram or whatever the case may be. It's about building over the long term. And sometimes that requires you to be under the radar and working hard and doing something. Yeah. So really wonderful to hear. Let's move on then to some of the main topics for discussion today in EdTech and corporate learning. Yeah. So let's start right at the beginning. You were part of the founding team at Go1. So firstly, where does the name come from? What is Go1? And what does the business do?
Yeah. So essentially, Go1 today is a learning ecosystem, probably the world's largest online professional learning or corporate learning ecosystem. So what we do there is we aggregate over 100,000 courses, learning resources, summaries, and bring that into one subscription and then offer that to individuals and organizations in probably now over 60 countries. And on the organization side, probably about 17,000 organizations. And so my proudest metric for that particular business is that, you know, every second, 3 learning resources are completed on our platform globally. And so really just trying to unlock that positive potential through a love for learning, which is why we exist as an organization. So Go1 is the name today, but we actually began being called Aduro, which means spark in Latin. Now, maybe we're a bit too nerdy, but we thought it was like, you know, brighter learning, spark. And we thought like that could scale for us. And then, when we went through our Combinator, early incubator we did in Silicon Valley, you know, speaking to the partners, they were like, look, one, the name Aduro might be difficult to pronounce in different geographies. Aduro, Adura, the D, the J, how do you pronounce it? But also there was then second thing, if you should also own your .com. And so we're like, you didn't own Aduro.com, we were Aduro LMS at the time. And we're like, okay, fine, then let's think about, like, you know, what a different name could look like. And, you know, you see, like, think about Go being the start for someone on their lifelong journey. But as one quickly realizes, I don't know if you know who owns Go.com.
I don't.
So Go.com is the holding company for Disney.
Okay. And so I couldn't afford. You were going to have trouble. It's fair to say.
It stands to reason. You know, touch wood one day. Couldn't necessarily acquire that one. And luckily, you know, my co-founders actually had built a web development business prior to Go1. And so it was the main Go1.co that we had from leading from Glass Obelisk, which was a very nerdy segue back in the day. And so we're able to then acquire the Go1.com and use that for our platform. And that's helped us scale globally in terms of that being like, you know, that go and start on one's learning journey.
Okay. That's a great overview, Melv. So that's, you aggregate over 100,000 courses in one subscription.
Yeah.
And your customers are over 17,000 organizations in 60 countries. So that's a phenomenal scale and wonderful to hear. There's a few things to double click on there. Yeah. So the first was, you didn't say we create 100,000 courses. You said we've aggregated 100,000 courses. So who's actually making these courses, or where does the content come from?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I guess today we still have some content. We still have content creation. So we acquired a business called Blinkist, which does course summaries. And Jeremy and Hogan and his team are now part of Go1. And so we do have a B2C and almost a course creation element to it. But I guess in the initial core business of Go1 around our online learning, we almost believe in curation over creation. And so the question is like, you know, there are many learning resources or content available out there. And so the question is, how do we go find the best in class and bring them into an environment where they are easy to access and track for organizations? And so Yes. I mean, in the early days, I tried to create content. I remember during Y Combinator, I was trying to create, because we actually began in compliance and then moved to more lifelong learning, from the business. And I was maybe creating a course, AB 1825, which was the sexual harassment awareness course for California. And I mean, spent more runway than I needed to on building this course, you know, got some guys online to develop it. And then like literally a month later, they changed the standard. And you know, when you speak to someone on the course, like, is this the latest version? And you're like,
and so like, all these months.
it's a different level of temperament, I think, but also in the same vein, you know, content changes so much. And so even though now we're seeing changes in terms of what people demand from a content perspective, but the reality is where we began was realizing that our game wasn't content creation. And it was more so trying to provide the tools such that we can get the best content, you know, right place, right context, to the right person.
Okay. Got it. I like the phrase as well. Curation over creation. So, is where you've chosen to go. Obviously, yeah. There are many content creators doing yes. very, very
doing
valuable
very well.
Work.
Exactly.
But that's where you've chosen to go. Okay. Got it. And maybe to make this tangible, let's just pick an example. There's 17,000, organizations that are your customers.
Yes.
So maybe just pick one. You don't have to name it, yeah. but give us an example. What do they use you for? And how do you help them?
No, fair. And I think it's interesting, you know, where many companies would often come to us initially for compliance and then they stay for the lifelong learning. But so one of our clients is a multinational, and they use us to train over 50,000 of their employees across different geographies. And what we were able to bring them was consistency, in the learning experience. Because we think about like multi-language, multi-geography, but also even just multi-understanding of the pedagogical approach within the organization. But more importantly, with our platform and the aggregation model, we strongly believe in training in the flow where someone is. And so our ability to integrate into their Slack and Teams for their learning was very important for them to, again, have that consistent learning journey. Because the reality is, you know, and studies have been done around completion rates in online learning and learning more broadly, is that, you know, people can enroll, but they often don't complete their courses. And the question is, how do you meet them where they are and get the right content at the right time? And so being able to use really smart technology on the back end to be able to make sure that someone gets the right courses at the right time, even at a global organization level, was quite key for us. And then most importantly, having that centralized ability to also then manage and also make sure the right stuff services in the right geographies, like local compliance and so forth, which can be fairly difficult to manage in a federated organization. So to the question, they came to us really from a point of one, consistent and quality online learning across different providers, but being able to offer that in a multilingual environment.
Okay. That's very interesting. Yeah. And you touched a bit on compliance training when you were talking there. So let me maybe give you what compliance training is to me. So a relatively recent example here in South Africa yeah. is the Protection of Personal Information Act, POPI.
Yes.
And all employees had to do training.
Yes.
And I received that email probably, you know, 5 or 6 reminders that you need to do your POPI training. You need to do your POPI training.
Yes.
And to be frank, it was a really boring experience to do that training. So I'm quite interested in the areas where you work. How have you gotten your completion rates up?
Yeah.
Have you made it more compelling in some way? I'd love to hear.
It's interesting. When you look at the numbers, there are small things actually are some of the biggest levers to get completion rates. So for example, if someone goes into a platform for the first time and they haven't been assigned a course, or it's like go and search, or there's no completion date to what's assigned to them, there's a drop so significantly their ability to complete it. So yes, you can say like, I want to come in and see everything, but if you, the first instance, and that's why for me, often the change management is so important, because something as small as that can literally affect your completion rates quite significantly when you think of the end outcome. So something like that. Obviously, key things are then like, you know, automated reminders and prompts. And I'm glad you got your email.
it wasn't on go one.
Sad, we need to change that. But I think even and then, I think what also like is also one example. Someone won't know the quality of a course until they get into the course. And so therefore, the platform which you access the content actually matters. Because there are many epic courses that no one will ever see because the platform sucks and they won't pull into the platform. So for us, the question is, how do we as a platform create the experience where you begin that thread from first interaction right through to actually accessing the courses and doing it that actually it brings you along, call it that journey, or that particular funnel. And so then when you get to the actual content itself, it's about saying, how do we partner? And so in my over decade of being in this space, I mean, I've worked with over probably 200 content providers, you know, about 100 odd, let's say, channel partners and so forth. And the content providers who have done the best are the ones who build content that they themselves would use and find exciting.
Mm.
And some of them have been acquired by very large companies and made lots of money. But I think it's also about taking that approach of everyone's a learner and say, am I enthused by this training? You can get the learning outcomes of the regulatory compliance, but you can still keep it interesting. And yes. I think that's where the onus is on those there. And obviously we can't control that. But the good thing about this platform is there is almost a ratings, or there's a ratings algorithm and so forth that one can put in where the most engaged courses that are actually completed will rank higher in our algorithm. And so it's important to also bear that in mind. And so that's how we also then move towards quality. So to your point, thinking about completion, it starts from first interaction with the platform right through to the quality of the content. I think often we focus on the quality of the course, but discount that people often don't get to the point of seeing the course in its environment.
That's really helpful. And in particular, the point on ratings and the better courses getting higher and you see more of them. Yeah. And also when you log on, what is the first thing that I see? What are the courses that are recommended to me? If that engine is strong, it can completely transform the experience from what I was slightly cheekily describing to you. I was intentionally doing that. Yeah. Okay. And if we talk then, on the distribution side in EdTech, distribution is always make or break. So you've reached these 17,000 corporates, and they've got thousands of employees themselves who are ultimately the end customer. Yes. How have you approached distribution? How did you think about whether to go sell directly to those customers or the corporates, and how do you reach them?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, for me, in business, always been about collaboration and partnership. And that's been true to our model of aggregation, working with content partners in terms of our actual product, but even then more so our, call it our distribution. And so I've been very intentional about building a distribution channel where we partner with companies or tools or platforms that are already, one, engaging our target stakeholder, let's say in the HR L&D function, but even already then engaging the learners where they are. So thinking about, I mentioned earlier, learning in the flow. So how do we partner with Slack, Salesforce, and Microsoft to be able to then offer learning directly through their current enterprise solutions, but also in the same vein, also partner with HR platforms and be able to integrate directly into them. So for example, if you're a big HR platform focusing on the full stack, you know, from, you know, benefits management to learning, the reality is that often you won't, you almost then default have like a learning management platform, but you won't necessarily have the content. And so what we see is that the people selling bookshelves, and we provide those books into those bookshelves. And so for us, it's about then saying, how do we partner with them? And ultimately we realize that our content library enables them to be more sticky, increase the average value for their account. And for us as a business, it actually lowers our cost of acquisition because they already have the relationship in there. And so it's shared value and created value. And so distribution's always been intentional for us as a business. But I mean, obviously on day one, it was more intentional about, you know, cold calling every customer and trying to close. But I think it's about realizing what value you create and who can create that value with you.
Okay, that's wonderful, that distribution. And this speaks to the point you were making earlier about it not being B2C. You're not going to see adverts of it when you know, watching a football game or whatever the case may be. But you are reaching your clients indirectly through partnerships, which is very, very effective from a customer acquisition cost perspective. So that's lovely to hear. And maybe if we just talk then about this market. So I've used the terms from the beginning of this conversation, EdTech and corporate learning. Yeah. How would you define this market that Gowan is in? Is it flat? Is it growing? Is it shrinking? Broad picture, what's happening in the market?
It is growing. The future is bright. That's interesting. You know, education, to your point, is a very nebulous term. And I think we really play in the professional learning and corporate learning space. And that market alone is about $300 billion. And so, you know, when I think about even like GoOne and our revenue growth, which isn't small by startup standards, I think we're so small relative to the wide space that exists in the space we're operating in. Because there are many legacy incumbents who I think could improve what they're doing, and that creates opportunity for us to add value and also grow the market together and blending that mix of, like, you know, what online learning and lifelong learning looks like. So interestingly, the market is growing for different reasons. And even take a step back and think about it from a macro perspective, is one, companies have realized that as opposed to, like, you know, once-off compliance training, they're seeing a big emphasis on continuous development. So therefore, there's a greater consumption of learning. Also because the cost of doing so is low. I mean, when we began trying to run around, you know, selling online learning, they're like, no, we want to get a per diem and go to a course for a day away at Sun City. Now there's a sense of saying, hey, look, you can actually have more learning opportunities and learning on the job in the flow, as I mentioned to you. And so that once-off to continuous development or continual development is definitely growing the market that we find ourselves in. But also in the same vein, what you're seeing is that even on the compliance side, you know, as different countries or states start regulating at their levels, for example, we had GDPR globally, now in Europe, and now we have Puppy in South Africa. And so that just doubles or the need for you to have a localized training solution. And so that long tail of training, particularly around compliance training, is getting longer as countries and states and governments start thinking through how they can also localize some of those requirements that need to be taught to particular employees.
$300 billion market. That's a lot larger than I was expecting. And if I just think through also some of the players in that market overall that people would have heard about, LinkedIn Learning, Udemy, Listed Business, Coursera, Listed Business in the US, and many others. So there are already large businesses in the sector. And another lens, I guess, of looking at it is it's only a couple of percent of revenue of what's made by large corporates.
Exactly. That's so true. So it's not exactly. I think it's also when corporates realize it's no longer about compliance, but also about retention.
Yes.
You actually are seeing that investment increase over time.
Yes.
Because, you know, even younger generations, but all generations want to feel like they're being invested in. Not everyone can go to that Harvard executive management program. And so they're seeing online learning as that bridge to offer those opportunities. So, for example, we work with a number of large financial institutions in South Africa where we bring the best-in-class training from the US used on Wall Street and then offer that to local banks. And so a normal transactor would never get that exposure. But because of our platform, you can now as a company offer that as a value add for the retention and development of your staff.
And personally, as a user, it's been wonderful to watch the development of the industry as well. I remember back in, it's probably now 2012 or so, I can't quite remember the exact year, but fairly early on, the completion rates of online courses were horrible.
Dismal.
And then I did a course probably about 2019 or somewhere in that sort of range with Get Smarter.
Yes.
And the human element had been added so much. So you were synchronous. You were in a class type of setting.
Yes.
There was an individual on the other end who you're talking to. And that social pressure of, okay, I've started this. I've got to complete it. I've got a group that I'm with.
Yeah.
It dramatically changes the completion rates and just the experience. It is like being as part of a class.
Exactly that. I think learning, the best learning, I think, is collaborative and community. Yeah. Ultimately.
100%. All right. Is there anything else on Go One that I haven't asked about, but that you'd like to speak about before we move on to some other aspects of your life?
No, look, I think the future is very bright in that particular space. I think ultimately, as I think we both believe, that technology and education is the greatest tool to change one's social economic circumstance. And I think that's where Go One has a lot of white space to go where it's going. But I think definitely on the journey, it has been one where I think COVID was definitely a big step change where companies were more familiar with using online learning in that perspective. And you definitely seeing the change where, you know, our most popular courses still remain like Microsoft Office and so forth. But definitely seeing a switch towards more soft skills and obviously a lot more AI activity now these days in terms of people trying to upskill themselves on.
I remember I had a book this thick called the Excel Bible in my first job when I first started. So I'm glad things have gotten a lot more digital than that. And this wasn't that long ago.
I know.
Well, at least it doesn't feel like it. Okay. So let's move on then from Go One. I enjoyed that conversation on Go One and EdTech and corporate learning. Let's move on. You transitioned then from an operator, a founding executive in Go One to an investor. And I mentioned up front that you're now a partner at Briga.
Yeah.
So why did you want to transition from an operator to an investor?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, you know, on our Go One journey, I mean, we probably raised over $450 million. And, you know, it was an interesting journey raising capital, but really struggled, one, to find African investors who understood what it meant to build a technology company, but also even the international investors, many of them hadn't necessarily been operators prior to doing so. And so what really thought to myself was like, look, I want to be the investor I wish I had when I was building my businesses. And so that's why, you know, at Briga, all the partners and team members, they are former operators and founders in their businesses. And so the question is, how can I help those founders pay new school fees? Because the reality is that founding journey can be lonely, especially when you are different from the archetype of what someone who a founder is or investors know, depending on where you grew up and the background you come from. And so for me, it's saying, like, look, how can I partner with, one, incredibly smart individuals to take bold ideas in sustainable and impactful businesses and sustainable companies? And so it's been a great journey being that sparring partner and also, I think, sharing the school fees that I've learned and hopefully help them make new mistakes.
I love that. I've seen the other side of this where an investor who's never had any operating or entrepreneurial experience at all, and it's been entirely theoretical, it can be challenging. I mean, the what goes on for a founder, there's so much coming from all sides. And as an investor, you're only seeing one lens of it.
Exactly.
So some of the recommendations and stuff then that one can come up with just aren't practical. So it's great that I didn't realize that everyone at Briga had an operating background. But that sounds like it would add a lot of value to the companies you invest in. I see then at Briga that you invest in EdTech amongst other industries. Correct. So this is the education investment podcast. We'll focus there on your time in EdTech. How do you think about the sector and where do do you want to play in the edtech market?
Yeah, I think edtech's an exciting space because, one, education is always impactful, and I think tech prize that scale that has never been seen before. And I think, you know, education, we know, is almost like, it almost like is a ladder, and as we mentioned earlier, but I think technology is almost that leveler. And almost like you can raise and also level the bar from that perspective. I think when you think about edtech investing, it goes both ways. One, because education is something that, you know, makes one feel soft and impactful and like you're doing something good. Often entrepreneurs forget about the business model and the sustainability and the finances of it. And so there's a big role to play. Like, look, okay, it's education, but how do we then create a sustainable business around the intervention you have in that particular space? But in the same vein, you also then find that there's sometimes a premium in education businesses because of that dynamic there. And so it's not only about like, you know, having an impact, but also saying like, you know, how do you have a good business model, but also have metrics to support that in that particular way. And so when I think about edtech, the market's definitely growing. I think what you have seen though over the last few years is that many of the larger, almost K-12 businesses in the edtech space have come under pressure. So if you think about Baiju and what happened to them and that blowout, it almost has created that risk-off experience for education, which is unfortunate because I think it's one or two companies of many. And I think ultimately they're the some that get the biggest air, but I think there's lots of potential in that space. And so we are still active in that space and we have one investment picking South Africa, on the edtech side of things as well.
Okay, let me follow you right down there. Please tell us about that.
Yeah, so at Brigga, we in Africa are pre-seed and seed focused. Typically, we tend to be the first institutional check into a business. And so the reality is you're coming in fairly early and also helping shape and craft what the business may look like. And so we really are backing the founders of the business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's about saying, how do those founders have an unfair advantage and unfair understanding of the problem they're trying to solve? And so in that particular business, you know, Nick and Ken and his team, Nick had built probably the largest tutoring company in South Africa, worked with over 100,000 parents over the time he built that business that's still ongoing today, and saw the insight that, you know, schools focus often on teaching study knowledge versus study habits. So the same way, okay, I think you know the answer. I know you know the answer here, but like we can know that if we drink water, go to the gym, and, you know, necessarily stay healthy, we could have do sit-ups, we could have a 6-pack or 8-pack. But the reality is, knowing that and having the system to do that are two different things. And so often, same thing with education. You can know the actual content of education, but if you know the study habits support it, it means nothing. And so the key thing what they focus on is now leveraging some global best practices around behavioral studies, around saying, how do they create a platform or program which includes coaching to actually improve study habits and create that discipline in children. And so it's very fascinating to see the work that they do both in South Africa, but also they have a very large client base. Most of their clients are actually in America. And so being able to, again, leverage that, you know, local team, but for international scale, but ultimately solving that problem of how do you teach young people, particularly in K-12, study habits that are sustaining.
Okay. It's learning how to learn effectively. Exactly. And in your example about building the 6-pack, you forgot to mention no beer. Probably the hardest part of
the whole equation. Chew water on the table.
Sure. Okay. And what's the name of the business?
Coachbit.
Coachbit. Yeah, Coachbit. Okay. Com, yeah. All right. Oh, that was lovely. And I haven't looked at the business closely before. Yes. I've heard of it. Yes. But I'll be looking at its development from a distance. Let's talk then a little bit about valuation. So you're an investor in early stage businesses. You've also started in early stage businesses. These are notoriously hard to value. You know, it's not DCF and all the stuff that yeah. people, discounted cash flow, all the stuff that people learn. How do you think about what is a reasonable price to pay for a stake in an early stage business?
Yeah, I think to your point, it's more art than science. And I think in our space, in the venture capital space, there are benchmarks one can consider. But also for us, there's also target ownership we're trying to achieve for the check that we put in. And so the reality is we aren't willing to pay any price to get into a deal because ultimately we are so active as investors and so hands-on that we want to make sure we have a meaningful stake in a business. Because the reality is in the venture world, you know, especially investing in Africa, for example, I can't own 0.01% of a company and return a fund. Whereas if I own 0.01% of Uber, I can probably return a fund and some. Mm. And so thinking about the scale of the exit and what the valuation you can realize for the business is important. Because the reality is that whether you're building a business, let's say in Uganda versus America, you can have the same revenue, but you get different multiples because of the market you're addressing from a global perspective. And so we think about valuation. It is often trying to think through how do we incentivize the founders to not dilute too much, but also realize that there may be further dilution in the business going forward. And so it often comes down to the norms. And so think about, like, you know, a pre-seed round, typically someone's raising between $100K, $100K to $500K. And so typically each round you expect to dilute between 20 and 10%. and thinking through what that looks like for post-money valuation as you think about that. But it is difficult, but definitely comes down to, one, the space they're in, the market they're in, and also just generally understanding what is that opportunity set given the founder.
Okay, got it. And are there any nuances in EdTech in particular?
Yeah, it's interesting. So EdTech's interesting one because, one, depending on who your customer is and your model, there are different prices. But that is unique. So for example, EdTech has seasonality because there's school terms and so forth. And so therefore, sometimes you see that seasonality and that may then create a discount. Whereas sometimes if you, let's say, a school management platform, you can have a multi-year contract. Those things rarely change because parents don't like downloading another app every 5 years. And so there are different nuances there which will affect the quality of revenue and therefore the valuation. I think.
Can I just pausing a little bit on that? So let's take the seasonality point. So to sort of put this tangibly, if I'm providing a tutoring service for exams, exams are whatever, twice a year. So I only make money in the 1 or 2 months before exams and the rest of the year I don't make money.
Yeah.
What was the other point you mentioned? Seasonality and?
Well, seasonality, I think also in the quality of the revenue in the contract. So if you're a school management system, I think, and it's like any organizations, I think that schools actually or have more inertia or less propensity to change systems. And so typically, if you're able to get into a school environment, you typically could be very sticky in that environment. For good or bad reason, depends how you view it. And I think from that perspective, you also then find it's a different quality of revenue. Because you won't necessarily write about someone churning, you know, in the next year, because the reality is both the institution and also the parent bodies and student body don't necessarily want to have change in systems that often, as an example.
Yeah, no, I 100% identify with that. It's hard to break into the school system, but once you're in, it's got to be very hard also for someone to dislodge you. my mother actually once said that in education, if you want to make enemies, try change something.
and that's so true. I think to your point about getting into schools, I mean, so I was part of building out a school payment solution. And I remember going out to different schools and, you know, I used to compare it like, you know, let's say the net value to us in the year was, let's say, $10,000 at the school, across again, the whole school. And that would take me literally like 6 months, 9 months to make the sale. Whereas in Go One, I could sign a $100,000 transaction with a corporate within like a month. And so often just comes down to that process. But to your point, the level of stickiness is different in the schooling environment.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I should say that that wasn't my mother's original quote, by the way. She was borrowing it from someone else. Not sure who the.
In course 2010.
Exactly. Okay. And you've seen a lot of businesses. You've been an operator and you've seen a lot of businesses come through your desk, of other founders that are seeking investment. And also just, I know you're active in seed priors, advising people, et cetera. What are some of the common pitfalls that you see? That if you were giving advice to someone to say you should avoid these.
Yeah, I think it's often, it's such an education because education is, you know, it's in Africa and sakta hat, that almost makes you feel good inside. And so we often forget about the business of it and you can get lost in the praise. And I think especially in early stages, even in big businesses, I find people get lost in actually keeping the main thing around running a sustainable business. Mm-hmm. I think that's something just to be very hard on because I think to myself, building out Go One, we had the most incredible talents and I'm very grateful for my partners that I had and the team that we're able to build. But I think if I was building a CRM, I don't think I would have attracted the same kind of like quality of people because people were willing to say, look, we are not paid the most, but the impact of what we're doing is so important. But it's also important to remember the main thing is to build a sustainable business and create value over time. So that's the thing which I think is one of the key learnings in there from that perspective. I think also being open to change. I think, you know, serving on Council of St. John's and advising education groups and so forth. I mean, thinking about how delivery models are changing, even introduction of AI now and what that means for education. I think often, you know, when someone says technology is not impacting what we're doing, I think it's almost the biggest flag. And I think it's about asking a tough question about how do you leverage and understand the technology of the day to improve what you do and deliver your service, whether you're bricks and mortar, whether you're online education platform. It's about thinking through those dynamics at length. And I think ultimately it's about saying, how do you find the right partners and know what you are good at, both in the team, but even as a, think about it from a school perspective. So example, you know, if you're a school and you're a good operator and you're doing, and you're focusing on what you're doing, it doesn't mean that you should be necessarily the person that does your IT maintenance or you should be the person that, for example, needs to manage your properties. And so it's important to think through as an operator or someone in the space, where is your skill set and really focus on that and then partner to achieve the rest.
And do you have any anecdotes on the distribution side of, in particular now within EdTech and education?
Yeah. I think often distribution is about finding who is already speaking to your customer. I think in education more than anywhere else, this trust takes time to build. Once it's there, it's very deep ingrained. Mm. And so even just a nudge or introduction or a co-branding with someone who has the trust or is trusted in that space can go a very long way to lower the barriers to accessing the opportunity that you may have. And so it's about asking that question of like, who has the trust or greater trust of the person I'm trying to engage, whether that's a principal or it is a company.
And if I were of all of the things that we spoke about there, of the risks and the pitfalls, that last point on distribution, I don't think we could stress enough. You get a lot of pitches where people are either thinking they're going to be able to sell somewhere at the top. It's one person who's going to get them out to all these schools. That could be, let's say, a group that owns 100 schools or whatever the case may be. It's exceedingly rare, actually, that a school group takes something like that on. A lot more, it's, the principal that's on site or individual teachers or whatever the case may be.
Yes.
Seen a lot of good talent and hard work and time and effort and good products, actually, die because they haven't gotten the distribution right and haven't thought sufficiently. So thanks also for sharing on that. And the final question then on EdTech and corporate learning from my side is on the social impact.
Yeah.
So how do you think about the social impact of the work that you do here?
Yeah, I think social impact is probably at the foundation of everything that I try to do professionally. I mean, so my career objective, as I mentioned to you, is create 100,000 sustainable jobs. And so I feel that one, technology is one of the levers you can really do to achieve that at scale, because no one's ever created 100,000 jobs and been poor or not had an impact in where they were operating. And so for me, if that's a North Star, we're able to achieve that. And so it's about then saying, what does impact actually look like? And the question comes down to, how are you improving someone's life? Whether that's through access, through opportunity, through helping them push the frontier of what they can achieve to be possible. And that's why for me, AI in the space we're in now is very exciting, because I don't think AI really right now is about, let's say, for example, automation. It's more about how do you augment human potential. And so from the work we do at Go One through to investing work we do today, so it's about how do we scale human potential in different capacities. And so I think hopefully everything we do is impactful. Often I find, I have many investors from around the world. I say, look, if you're investing in Africa, everything's impact, because there's so much one can do with the challenges that we face. But I think it's about also being intentional about, if I make this investment, what am I catalyzing in terms of impact?
That's wonderful, Malf. And I mentioned at the beginning, it's been wonderful watching your impact so far, and I'm really looking forward to seeing you get to that 100,000 number in jobs created. And I can attest for our audience that you're not a politician. So every election cycle, we get a promise of 6 million jobs or 1 million jobs or 2 million jobs or whatever. It changes in every cycle. You have been consistent on this 100,000. So I can, our audience can rest assured. I'll be policing it and watching your progress towards that 100,000.
Thank you.
All right. And as we close off on EdTech and corporate learning, is there anything that I haven't asked about that you'd like to talk about within that topic, or should I come back to you?
No, I think nothing in particular. I think the reality is to understand that not all learning takes place on a platform or in a classroom, and to think about, when last did you take a formal course? And that's how for us, for example, thinking through partnering with Blinkist and acquiring them was like, often you learn through, for example, an article someone shares with you or something you see on a social media platform. And so often it's about being more holistic in what one views as learning, because often people feel because they aren't doing formal courses every year, they aren't learning and growing and developing. But often it's more about how you're in a space where you're being exposed to things that help you think about things differently and expose your learning frontier. And I think it's something which you often get lost when you think of corporate training, you think of a corporate versus lifelong learning.
That's wonderful. And this is a very meta discussion, because the Education Investment Podcast aims to do exactly that. Aims to be a resource for us all to learn together in the sector that we love. Okay. So I'm going to come back then to you as we end off the conversation, Malf.
Yeah.
And I ask the same concluding question to all of our guests. And it's my favorite question of the entire interview. Yeah. And that's, please tell us about your favorite teacher or educator.
Yeah. And I've been privileged to have a number of educators that really influenced my life. One that stands out was my grade 2 teacher, Mrs. Lowenthal. And coming into grade 2, I was somehow a recalcitrant or a naughty child. I just remember for the first term, I think the teacher at the time, wouldn't mention her name, was throwing my things around the classroom and said I was going to be a failure and I wasn't focused. And it was a really tough time. And I can't remember the detail of it, but I just remember that I was the kid that was just always in trouble. And
grade two.
I mean, I started young, clearly. School of Hard Knocks. And so definitely, Ms. Lonthal, that particular teacher, I think actually got engaged and went off on leave to get married on honeymoon. And so Ms. Lonthal came in. And I think just the importance of not only teachers believing in you, and also just speaking positive energy into your life and saying, look, one day you'll be great. You're a leader. I can see the skills you have. One day you'll be head boy. She called it a very long time, because I ended up being head boy 5 years later and head boy in high school. But I think definitely I think the role of a teacher is often to see the best and unlock the best potential in people. And I definitely found that Mrs. Lowenthal had the patience, the understanding to not only get to know me first, but then also to support me on that journey. And so it was very helpful and definitely impactful on my journey as well.
It's a wonderful tribute to Mrs. Lowenthal, and I hope she gets to hear that wherever she is. Mel, it's been an absolute masterclass on EdTech and corporate learning, and I also enjoyed the conversation. I had fun. So thank you for sharing on these topics and also sharing some of your personal journey as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Cheers. Thanks, Mel.
Cheers.